Is there a dot between NYC and RR? Go ahead.
It is, Dick. It's nyc.rr.com.
Okay. Looks like you've got a couple of offers there, Ray, to really find out is the rig working and then offer to get it fixed. KC2MMY. My call letters are K2 Romeo India Whiskey. Over to you, Ray.
Okay, gotcha. K2RIW, KC2 Mike Yankee. And yes, all right, thanks for the offer. And 2EO, I hear you all the time on 2 meters. I know a lot of you. The name's Ray, you should know by now. But I know Alex and the other guy that asked all the questions. Can't remember his name right now because I'm getting tired. But it looks like it's, something must have happened to the radio. You know, I bought it from somebody, and it worked when I first got it. And, you know, the fact that I had a gigolat antenna, it looks like something probably did happen to it. But maybe we could do that test sometime. My health's a little bad right now. I have some kind of infection in my face. Nobody knows what it is. So I'm going to a lot of doctors. Definitely try to work something out, and thank you so much for all the information, because now I have some tests I can run to see what's going on. So thanks for the answer to the question, and back to Ned.
Good luck with that project, Ray, and when you find out what it is, come back and let us know, because your situation might be somewhat similar to other people who are listening. Okay, we're getting back down to the deeper subject that Wesley proposed this week, which was, first of all, spatial resonance of a coil, but before that it was the Thompson experiments, and as I see it, the Thompson-like experiments that also Tesla was involved in involves whether or not you create a strong enough E-field or H-field inside of a partial vacuum that the glass, you will get a glowing of the gas, a so-called Thompson discharge. And so, that's been studied for quite a while. One of the questions that Wesley has asked from time to time is, can you get electrons to flow in a vacuum? And the answer is almost no. If I've got two metal plates in a perfect vacuum, in theory I can put any voltage in the world across there and nothing will happen. Well, there's a slight catch. You really do that in the real world, put an extremely high voltage across two plates that are in a perfect vacuum. Eventually a cosmic ray is going to come along and hit one of your metal plates. That's going to free up an electron. That electron that gets freed up will go flying toward the positive plate if it's near the negative plate. And if there was only a steady state voltage present, that probably would be a single event that stopped. But if it was a RF voltage being applied across the two plates, you're now likely to initiate multipactor. And multipactor is an electron flow in a perfect vacuum. But the electrons are coming from the metal plates of the two antennas. In the case of the Mercury program, the dipole on S-band on the outside of the Mercury capsule.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Next. That dipole was made out of materials that would support multipactor in a vacuum. So depending on what materials the dipole is made out of, you were getting secondary electrons boiled off by the ones that were coming from the previous cycle, moving at a high enough velocity to impact the metal plate and boil off some more. Now, when it comes to that YouTube video on so-called spatial resonance of a coil, let me drop. When it comes to a coil's self-resonance, usually when a coil is used in a circuit where you want it to be an RF choke, there is a particular frequency where the stray capacitance across the coil and the frequency that's being applied makes it a parallel LC circuit where you get better RF choke and you get a perfect open circuit at that particular frequency. And at some other frequency, the distributed capacitance and the inductance of the coil gives you a series resonant circuit. And so now the coil, instead of acting like an open circuit, it acts almost like a short circuit. But in this particular experiment, the person was not putting a capacitor across the coil. He was just suspending the coil on dielectric materials far away from a table. putting a probe nearby, or maybe making one contact to the coil, sweeping the frequency that he's exciting the coil with, and had another probe to an oscilloscope and a probe to a millivolt meter nearby. And so as he sweeps the frequency that he's applied to the coil, eventually he saw an increase in the response on those two pieces of instrumentation. From my point of view, he calls it spatial resonance. It really is the fact that there's a stray distributed capacitance in the turns of the coil, and the fact that the coil has a certain amount of inductance, and when you hit the right exciting frequency, the coil will experience resonance. And in the case of pushing your son on a swing, you're doing it in resonance. You're pushing at very specific times as he's about to move forward, and each one of your pushes becomes a cumulative energy, and eventually he is swinging at a higher and higher magnitude. Let me drop. And if you did the experiment of pushing him at different times, you could easily get the situation where all of your pushes do not add up, because you're doing it out of resonance. So the magic of resonance is that even though the amount of energy you're adding is very small, each individual cycle of the energy you're adding accumulates. That's the magic of resonance. That's part of how a grid dip meter will couple RF energy from the coil on the grid dip meter over to your tuned circuit. So even though the coupling could be extremely light in any of these cases, resonance will allow the voltage to build up as long as the circuit is resonant. And a coil suspended in space is not a pure inductor. You can't build a coil without there being stray capacitance between the turns and from end to end. There's always distributed capacitance within almost any reasonable way of winding a coil. Therefore, every thing that you call coil will have at least one parallel resonance because of that period of that distributed capacitance. And you could call it spatial resonance if you want. And he made a great big point that the spatial resonance is very different than the self-resonant frequency, the spatial resonant frequency. But he didn't tell us what those two frequencies were and how far apart they are. N2XJN, the guy who asked the original question. K2RIW, go ahead, Wesley.
N2XJN, good evening, everybody. You touched two subjects. One is the Thompson experiment, and the other one is the spatial resonant frequency. Now, as far as the Thompson experiment, Thompson and Nikola Tesla were two direct competitors. And the issue was in the field of proper assignment, which was whether the phenomenon of glowing circle is of electrostatic nature, or it is of the electromagnetic nature. Now, if you have that glass envelope, when I spoke about that with John early during the week, I was using a term incandescent light bulb, which is absolutely incorrect, so anybody who was listening to that, I straight it up. Now, from one side, there was a tin foil of that, let's say, a sphere, kind of sphere. Lighten up. And the tin foil cup looks like a part of the female lingerie. Now, excuse the wording, but it's just me who does have a problem with the proper description. At the place where the nipple is supposed to be, there was a wire connected, and it was connected to the either large object or it was connected to the earth ground. Well, Tesla stated that the coating was connected to the ground or large object, and luminosity of the circle was considerably increased. And he claimed that it was evidently due to the electrostatic action. As Thompson was rather trying to stand about the electromagnetic character of this phenomena. But the circle was vertical, and the circle was only present in the vicinity of the right-hand side of the of that glass envelope, which was a sphere, kind of, and it was so from the left-hand side we had the woman cup, and from the right-hand side we had a coil. Now, there was no filament over there. There was nothing to heat there. And to exam.
I am guessing that a cold cathode fluorescent tube obeys some of these characteristics. In the case of a cold cathode fluorescent tube, which is the major source of illumination on almost every one of our laptop computers nowadays, eventually they're going to become light-emitting diodes, but for the time being, almost every laptop computer has a source of light, which is a squiggly, it looks like a neon tube that squiggles back and forth, but it really gives off white light. And the cold cathode fluorescent tube is being hit with something like 2,000 volts. There's a mercury vapor inside. There is no filament. There's just two metal plates on the end, and you're expressing that 2,000 volts across the two ends. And so how the process gets started, I'm not sure. But as long as one electron eventually gets released and starts impacting those mercury vapor molecules that are inside, they give off ultraviolet light. The ultraviolet light hits the phosphor that's on the inside of the tube, and out comes white light. So as long as the voltage is high enough, and as long as you've got the right gaseous material inside of a tube, and whether that voltage is a DC voltage or an AC voltage will give you a different effect. But as long as the voltage is high enough, that has the ability to accelerate any free electrons that might be present. Let me drop UA1 PPA. Okay, Mr. Chase is here. As long as that voltage is high enough, and as long as there's a free electron somewhere that begins the ionization process, an impact ionization, you now get a significant flow of current through that gaseous material. That in turn will cause it to give out light, and that light is in some cases ultraviolet, in some cases is a blue glow. The small number of electrons that are inside of my 6L62 on that first transmitter I had as a novice ham radio operator was also showing me this effect. I could call it a Thompson effect that I was seeing. So without a doubt, it works better with a filament. But if the voltage is high enough, you don't need a filament. The cold cathode tubes are used on our laptop computers because they're more reliable. Because the filament was there would allow it to work with a lower voltage. That's the good news. But the filament is something that wears out. And to not need a filament gives that tube a lot more light, a lot more longevity. WA1VVH, I wonder if you have something to add to this one, Harold. K2RIW and the TechNet. Yeah, he comes from upper Massachusetts, 170 miles away, Harold, and sometimes he signs into the TechNet. I thought this is one of those times. So, the Thompson effect really is a glow discharge when accelerated electrons are impacting a gas, is my guess. Or if they're impacting a phosphorus surface and giving off light. So accelerated electrons impacting gas molecules or phosphor molecules are going to give off light. And you can accelerate them with a steady state DC field or an AC field or combinations of that. That's my guess as to what's happening here, but I'm not sure, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Yeah, N2XJN. I concentrated myself on a part of the article that I have sent you, which stated about the luminosity being excited in the tube, and we with that little bit ancient English, there is a statement saying that it is absolutely necessary that the conductor should be closed. The instance of the ordinary exhaust tube of preferably a large diameter be surrounded by the spiral of the thick copper, and it states on it that evacuated glass envelope does not forbid a circle to be established, a light circle to be established. If you could relate to the nature of this phenomenon, whether this is a coming from the electrostatic origin or it is coming from the electromagnetic origin. I'm trying to find the character of this phenomenon. Back to you.
Okay, an electromagnetic wave traveling through a vacuum of free space can have any frequency you like. Everything from DC to cosmic rays, that's a lot of spectrum in between, about 10 to the 20 cycles of variation. If it happens to be 550 nanometers of wavelength, our eye responds to it, and we call it green light. What's really happening? That electromagnetic wave is hitting the retina of our eyes and making a chemical change. I guess it is at the right frequency. It's an E field, an H field, but I think it's the E field that's doing most of the work, is my guess, and it excites our retina. If I've got a high voltage AC or a high voltage DC in a partially evacuated glass tube, I mean, he exhausted those tubes and he thought he was sucking out the air. We now know that the word vacuum is a very relative word. There are kinds of vacuums that look like it's an extremely good vacuum, but the total number of molecules inside that vacuum are really a huge number. And those molecules can do all kinds of things under excitation from an AC or DC wave that's nearby. Also, I could have a glass envelope. Let me drop. I could have a glass envelope which is absolutely empty. Nothing inside the glass envelope except what used to be air, and now I've sucked out all the air. I've made an extremely good vacuum, but not a perfect vacuum. And now I put metallic objects on the outside of that glass envelope and start putting AC or DC signals on those metallic objects. I will be exciting a local electrostatic. I will be exciting an electric field, and maybe a magnetic field, but certainly an electric field inside of that glass envelope, inside of that low content vacuum. And so if I make the external metallic objects have large enough AC or DC voltages, I'm pretty sure I can get the Thompson effect to occur inside of a glass envelope with nothing in there except
KC2 QIQ.
There's nothing in there except a small number
existing by itself and circulating 90 degrees, being vertically polarized towards the earth. The magnetic is horizontally polarized, and then we have at 90 degrees the electrical part of it. Now, my statement is these two coexist together. You cannot have one only in this particular situation, what you describe. And don't
see it.
Let's see what Glenn's got to say on this one. Go ahead, Glenn. I wonder if you've seen Thompson-like effects in partial vacuums. You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, it's interesting. I remember reading about them. I've never done one myself, but my understanding of what the Thompson, that whole experiment was all about initially was that they took a tube, they emptied out most of the air, or as much as they could, out of it to bring the pressure inside it very, very low, applied a large DC voltage, plus on one side, minus on the other side, and they saw a deflection of electron particles that created illuminating light on one end of the tube, basically the beginning of the original cathode ray effect. And I guess it really struck Thompson quite a bit that he broke it up into two experiments. The first experiment was after he applied the large voltage and saw the illumination of the... he assumed that the electrons were being deflected as a particle. Let me let it drop for a second.
And by the way, Glenn, where do you think the electrons were coming from? Go ahead.
Well, he was assuming initially in his experiment that the particles were actually from the makeups of the materials being used. In other words, the metal plates on either side, and the as the voltage was being applied across those potentials, he was using copper plates on either side, and the electrons were being emitted from one plate to the other in a cathode ray. That's basically how he explained it. And then he did two experiments after that, broke them up. One was, could he deflect it with a magnetic field? And he applied magnetic forces and saw that, yes, he could deflect the field, determining that it was truly a particle, not just a wave. And then he said, if I can do it with a magnetic field, what about an electrostatic field? If I put that around, could I deflect it? And he found that it would do that as well. So he kind of made a double proof with his experiment, initially, you know, fathering the idea of the cathode ray tube by proving that the electron was a particle being deflected. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I believe Thompson was given credit for proving that the individual atoms and molecules, which used to be considered indivisible, could be separated into subcomponents. One of those subcomponents is a charged particle that eventually became called the electron, and I think Thompson is accredited with inventing or discovering the presence of free electrons. Is that your recollection also, Glenn? Go ahead.
Absolutely, Dick, right on. He won a Nobel Prize for that. I was going to try to get to that, but I figured if I stayed out any longer, I'd time out the machine. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Who was that?
Tony, WWZW, with a quick comment.
Go ahead, Tony.
I believe the first person, maybe you can someone could back me up on this, the first person to describe matter, especially electricity, with the word particle, may have been Benjamin Franklin. Can anyone verify that?
Yeah, right now we may not have anyone here again to prove that Franklin called it a particle. I believe it was Franklin who decided, in the case of a battery, which is the positive terminal, which is the negative terminal, and he intended the positive terminal to be the one where the particles were flowing out of, whatever those particles were. He had a 50-50 chance. You could say he got it backwards. So we've had this mix-up of current. When current flows left to right, is it negatively charged particles or positively charged particles that are doing the flowing? And we got two schools of thought on that one. For a long time with vacuum tubes, we accepted the fact that negative charged particles were flowing, and we would say current flows from the cathode to the anode of a vacuum tube. And all of the 1960 schools, that was true. All of a sudden came solid-state components, and we decided to make it a little bit easier, and now we think that current is the movement of positively charged particles. In the case of semiconductors, that really means holes are moving in many cases instead of electrons. And so they act like positively charged particles. They're oppositely charged electrons, if you know what I mean, but they're really holes. They're places where the electrons can go, but they're missing. So I run into lots of problems with electronic engineers, old and new school, in the same room at the same time. Let me drop. And somebody is standing at the board giving a lecture saying, the current flows from here to here. The current flows in that direction. And I have to raise my hand and say, whoa, wait a minute now. You got half the people on each school in this room. In your mind, when you got that arrow going to the right and you say current is flowing to the right, in your diagram, in your mind, in your explanation you're giving us, is current the movement of positively charged particles? And sometimes you get a blank stare, and sometimes you get either one of the answers. So there's a bit of an ambiguity there. But it looks like Thompson was given credit and a Nobel Prize for discovering these subatomic particles, subatomic particles called electrons. I wonder who was given credit for discovering the protons and neutrons. But I think we've got a partial explanation of the Thompson effect. I think it is a impact ionization of moving charged particles hitting a partial vacuum, some kind of gaseous material in there. If you had an absolutely perfect vacuum inside of a Thompson tube, and if there was no phosphor anywhere, I don't think light would be given off with reasonable voltage experiments. N2XJN, K2RIW.
N2XJN. The problem that I have is trying to justify your statement that stands about the creation of the electrical field inside the vacuum tube.
Okay, in the case of that 6W6, which is the poor man's equivalent of a 6L6 tube that I was using, a beam tetrode or beam pentode, I think it was a beam tetrode tube, power beam tetrode it's called. And what that really means is that the control grid wires and the screen grid wires were aligned with each other so that the stream of electrons coming from that cathode that went in between the wires of the control grid had a chance of also going in between the co-aligned wires of the screen grid and then zipping right onto the plate without touching the screen grid. That was the whole idea of a beam tetrode. But the vacuum inside of that tube was far from perfect. It was good enough, but far from perfect. Therefore, every time I pressed down the key and 25 watts of B-plus voltage and current was being put onto that tube, and it was oscillating, in my case, at 7.15 or 7.175 megacycles in the novice CW band, those electrons, zillions of them, going from cathode to plate, were hitting the few air molecules that were there and giving off this characteristic blue glow. And I had a pretty good set of eyes in those days. Let me drop. I had a pretty good set of eyes in those days where I could focus at very close objects. I could put a small object on the tip of my nose and focus on it. So as I brought my face up to this fairly clear glass bulb of the 6W6 tube, I could see the blue glow in between the control grid wires and the screen grid wires. I could see the fact that the blue glow was concentrated in certain areas. I could see where the electrons were flowing. I was getting a beautiful visual picture of those electrons hitting those air molecules as they flowed from cathode through those two grids to the plate. Beautiful picture. And that picture would flash on and off every time I pressed down the key. I also had a nice blue glow coming off my 866 mercury vapor rectifiers, but that's another whole story. And that's a real mercury vapor in there that helps the conductivity of that rectifier. But in the case of the 6W6 vacuum tube, I was looking at a mediocre quality vacuum tube. If the vacuum tube was absolutely perfect, if the Gettering had really done its job, I'm pretty sure there would have been no air molecules for the electrons to hit, and therefore there would have been no blue glow. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Question.
Go ahead, John.
Dick, that area of the blue glow, is that considered in the space charge region?
I don't think so. In the case of a diode rectifier, you sometimes get a very thin layer of charged particles very close to the cathode, which I thought was called the space charge region. And if your voltage between cathode and anode is high enough, it sucks them away. But let me think now. Emission limited. In the case of a tube that you want to generate a specific amount of noise, I think it was called the 555 tube, but I'm not sure of the model number of the tube. that they use between 0 and roughly 1 gigahertz. You would apply a positive voltage on the plate of this diode-like tube, and you would carefully adjust the filament voltage to control the amount of current. You wanted it to be emission limited. When the vacuum tube was carefully heated to just the right temperature, so that for the particular applied voltage it was emission limited, in other words, in theory, every single electron that left that cathode would be sucked up to the plate, and therefore you would generate a very specific, predictable amount of broadband radio frequency noise. All you had to do is know the amount of current that was flowing through this emission-limited tube, and in theory you knew the exact amount of noise that that tube was generating. And to which you were about to ask yourself, let me drop. Why don't I just control the current by lowering the plate voltage and run it at full filament voltage? You run it at full filament voltage, more electrons leave the cathode than is required to conduct that amount of current. And the excess electrons gather around that cathode, and that becomes the so-called space charge. So there's a cloud of electrons, not all of which are being used very near the cathode, if you are not emission limited. And as such, you now have different statistics of the individual electrons flowing, and therefore a less predictable amount of noise. By making it emission limited, by lowering the filament voltage so that every single electron that left that cathode was immediately sucked up to the plate, now you knew exactly what the relationship was between radio noise being generated by this noise tube and the current that was flowing. And therefore you had no space charge in that environment. That's my little bit of understanding on this one, John. Casey Du, WGB, K2RIW.
Okay, great answer, Dick. Very descriptive, too. All right, back to Ned.
You got it, Wesley.
Yeah, this line, contrary to the Thomson findings, have made another experiment, and just because of the sake to properly assign that to either the electrostatic nature or electromagnetic nature, he put a glass envelope that was evacuated, and he slip the secondary cylinder, glass cylinder, placed vertical, so the globe was inside. Now, in case of the luminosity, he was able to know that the luminosity was there when he wound the coil on that glass cylinder. That's the picture number, the figure number 6. If you take a look at the same article that I have sent it to you. And there was a note stating that what the action was wholly if the action was wholly electromagnetic, there would no change could possibly have been observed. With all this explanation that happened tonight, and also that beautiful example of the vacuum tube, radio tube that you have used, and that circle that you have observed, I have a problem with the fact that whether the same mechanism applies to evacuated tube with no filament at all. And the second question is, would justify the fact that in the first picture that we were talking about, the presence of that circle was...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Sorry about that. That in case of the first drawing that we discussed, when we had the coil on the right-hand side, the presence of the light circle was nearby the vicinity of that coil, but what justified the fact that luminous circle was not 3 millimeters closer to the coil, or 3 millimeters further out of the coil. We didn't touch that. Why the placement geometrically takes the place exactly there, if the question that was given by John should be applied to this subject. Back to you.
I do remember seeing that Tesla picture, or maybe it was a Thompson picture, of a round glass bulb that was evacuated, and there's a glass cylinder, vertical glass cylinder on the outside of it, and a coil of wire is wound on that glass cylinder. And I'm fairly sure, and it wasn't clear then as to what was happening, but I'm going to make some guesses, that if by one means or another I excite a large enough resonant cyclic voltage on that external coil that's on that cylinder, at each instant of time, I could decide to stop the action, stop time, so to speak, as far as my analysis is concerned, at the instant that the maximum positive voltage is on that coil. The upper end of the coil is positive, and the lower end of the coil is negative if the center was grounded, or vice versa. If you're grounding the bottom, the most positive voltage is on the top. And the way Mother Nature forms equipotential sheets of, my charge is not the right word. In other words, around each metallic object, when I've got voltage on it, I could, in theory, use the right kind of an electroscope probe, an extremely high impedance probe, and probe the local electrostatic field. And it's not necessarily made of electrons. In other words, to take a simple case, I've got two flat plates that are 3 inches apart, and each one of them is 4 inches square. And I put a high voltage DC between those two plates. And now I could take my probe of my electroscope and put it in...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I could put my my electroscope probe at various places in between those two plates. Start off right next to the bottom plate, right in the center of it, and slowly raise it until it's eventually at the top plate, right in the center of it. And I could measure the voltage, the apparent electrostatic voltage at each one of those places. And I could now move the probe a little bit to the left, a little bit to the right, and then go up and down and repeat the process. I would eventually discover that the equipotential locations are as if I had a whole bunch of parallel sheets of paper in between the bottom plate and the top plate. But over at the edges, I would get a fringing effect. There'd be a curvature to those pieces of paper, so to speak. So once you study electrostatics and electrodynamics, in theory, when you know the shape of the conductors and the voltage that's present, you can, in theory, plot what electrostatic field is present at each point in three-dimensional space. Let me drop. So once I accept that concept by which I can plot voltages, even though in theory nothing is there, well, in reality you've got this extremely highly resistive material called air. And would I still be able to make that electroscope probe experiment in a perfect vacuum? I think I'd have a problem if I was doing it with DC voltages. If I was doing it with AC voltages, I know it would work. But with DC voltages, I think it might not work in a perfect vacuum. But with air, which is a very, very mildly conducting substance, volumetric conducting substance, I'm pretty sure I could always do this experiment. So now, once I've got these external metallic objects, whether they be capacitor plates, whether it be a coil of wire, no matter what, and in between I put a glass envelope, and I've got now partial vacuum in that glass envelope, I know I can, from the outside of that glass envelope with those metallic objects, excite a electrostatic or changing electrostatic. I can change the E field configuration, the voltages versus positions, the equipotential voltage positions inside of that partial vacuum envelope. And if the external exciting signal is large enough, I could create some glow discharge effects inside of that envelope. So even though there's no conductor in there, from the outside, I still have some control of what E-field those air molecules inside are being subjected to. And if I make the E-field strong enough, I think I can make a cold cathode fluorescent light out of it, so to speak. It wouldn't be fluorescent unless I put some phosphor in there, but I could get a deep purple glow in a dark room out of that partial vacuum inside of that glass envelope.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
With no metallic objects inside of that vacuum envelope, I think I could make that that substance inside glow as long as what I'm doing on the outside is large enough in magnitude. So, is that a electromagnetic wave I put in there? I don't think so. I think I've made a dynamically changing electrostatic wave, so to speak. In other words, I've created local E-field. But it doesn't take free electrons to do it until the point that I want light to happen. Now I've got to be freeing up electrons. If the voltage is large enough, and if the vacuum is not perfect, I will eventually create some kind of a glow discharge, which is a partial breakdown, which is avalanche discharge. It's a chain reaction effect taking place on those air molecules, the few of them that are there, inside of that glass envelope. So, an electromagnetic wave in pure vacuum, I'm convinced, cannot be bent with gravity, cannot be bent with a magnetic field, cannot be bent with a solid state, with a steady state E field. You can't deflect an electromagnetic wave in a perfect vacuum. Put it in the right kind of a medium, and now I can do all kinds of things to it. An ionosphere is one of those mediums. But with rare exception, I don't think you bend that wave when it's in that electromagnetic wave, TEM wave. I don't think you bend it, can bend it when it's in a perfect vacuum. That's my belief. N2XJN, K2RIW.
N2XJN. If we have the electromagnetic wave, the magnetic part of the electromagnetic wave is always horizontal. And the electric part is vertical, towards that horizontal. And then we have a vertically placed a glass cylinder in which inside of that cylinder we have a glass envelope that is evacuated from the air. Let's say partially. I agree with you that we don't deal with a perfect vacuum. Now, here's what's happening. When you stated that the electric part is penetrating, it makes the sense, but at the same time, if we have a specific inductive capacity of the medium between the primary and the secondary, and we increase that, or let's say we have only one coil, then the magnetic part, because of its horizontal nature, will penetrate the glass envelope that is evacuated inside, not the electric one. Back to you, sir.
An electromagnetic wave, and the one that you're describing, the E field is vertical, the magnetic portion of it, the H field, is horizontal, and is propagating either directly toward me or directly away from me. It's a flat sheet of energy, so to speak, coming toward me or coming away from me. In free space, that wave propagates beautifully. There isn't one single electron there. And yet there's an E field there. And that's a hard one. And the way it's explained is the E field is there because there is a rate of change of magnetic field. And the magnetic field, those magnetic field lines eventually have to close on themselves. They might go out to infinity, but they eventually close on themselves. So the changing magnetic field, and we don't know what that's caused by, per se. We don't know what it really is. We call it a field. We call it something we can measure. We can put probes in there, and we can say, yeah, it's present. But what is it? That's a tough one. But its rate of change by Maxwell's equations creates a electronic, creates an E field. And the E field's at right angle to the lines of the H field. And I used to think that electrons were really being transmitted through space. I now know not a single electron, in theory, left that antenna on the moon when I was listening to that signal down here on Earth from the Apollo 15 and Apollo 16 astronauts. Something went through space. It has essentially no mass. It has essentially no electrons. And yet, enough energy that was predictable in magnitude, let me drop, enough energy of a predictable magnitude arrived at my antenna in Farmingdale. I picked it up with that parabolic dish antenna that you can see on the front cover of the August issue, 1972 QST magazine, and with that feed horn made out of an American paint can and a Scottish oatmeal can, I picked up the signal at the focal point of that parabolic dish. It went into the borrowed parametric amplifier at 2287.5 megacycles, down into a converter, and eventually came out of the loudspeaker and appeared on the spectrum analyzer screen. And I'm watching the astronauts talk to Earth, listening and watching it. A fun project. But throughout that project, I asked myself, at the beginning when they turned on the transmitter, not a single electron left the moon. Something went through the hard vacuum of space. In theory, that space between the Earth and the moon contains almost nothing, in theory. And the wave itself is some kind of energy that we call photons, but they don't have any mass, but yet they convey energy, and that energy arrives at my antenna in Farmingdale. And I've worked with radio all my life, 40 some odd years, and quantitatively I think I understand it. You tell me how much signal goes into what kind of an antenna, you tell me how far away, what the medium is in between, and to a certain degree I can tell you how much signal arrives at the other end. But I don't know really what the hell it is. I know it goes through a vacuum. And we give it fancy words. Photons, electrostatic field, electromagnetic field, transverse electromagnetic field, E field, H field. We got a lot of words. We got a lot of experiments to tell us how it acts. But at the molecular level, I'm still troubled. I don't know what it is. And I think you're asking a lot of questions in a similar manner. And to
repeater, time out, cancel.
And to XJN, K2LIW. You think we'll ever get to the bottom of this one, Wesley?
No, well, I'm trying to use your brain and brain of others that are helping me to understand the phenomenon. I don't want to drag this to the extreme. But let's say, in order for me to place you at a certain given point, and I recall this when 2 years ago I was heavily studying a spatial positioning with Euclidus mathematics, as this one I found much easier than the Cartesian one. And I need X, Y, Z. Now, in case of the electromagnetic wave, we have X and Y. So we have a magnetic field, and then we have the electrostatic field. And I'm thinking about the positioning of that circle, the glowing circle inside of evacuated envelope, and I simply cannot understand why the circle is, let's say, 3 millimeters from the coil that is placed on the outside of the envelope. Why is that 1? And why is that 5? And to XGN.
I've got a very similar question with my Wimshurst machine. When I set my Wimshurst machine at a certain gap spacing, and I turn the handle and it generates high voltage, and it starts making arcs in air. There's a certain way I can set it up so that the arc I see in air does not begin at the negative electrode. It begins a couple of millimeters in front, maybe 1 or 2 millimeters in front of that electrode. The arc begins and then proceeds over and touches the positive electrode. Why is that gap always there? Don't understand that one. I think it's related to the space charge phenomena that John was talking about earlier. When you've got more electrons boiling off the cathode than is required, for some reason they congregate very close to the cathode. They become a cloud of electrons close to the cathode. And by the same token, with this glow discharge you're talking about, I know that I've seen some of these pictures of Thomson tubes. Let me drop. Where in the Thomson tube you're getting a glow discharge in space, in three-dimensional space, but the glow discharge is not a continuous one between the two electrodes. There's a gap on where the glow begins. Now, maybe I can guess that in the case of the Thomson tube, it takes a certain length of distance for the three electrons in there that have become a plasma. They have to be accelerated to a certain velocity before they encounter the air molecules at a half enough, high enough velocity to do an impact ionization. So right close to the plate where they're coming from, there isn't a glow real fast, real close, because they're not moving fast enough yet. That's a guess on my part as to why there's a gap. You got a question on this one, John?
Yes, Dick, sort of. Have you ever tried your Windhorst machine and looking at it at that initiating arc and rotating the machine to different cardinal points on the compass? Did you notice the arc changing its initiating position?
Yes, I've done that experiment, and if the change in position did happen, it was an extremely minor one. What I think you're saying is that if I change the orientation of the local magnetic field, would that account for it? And I think the answer is no. Whether I operated the machine where the plus and minus were east and west, or the plus and minus were west and east, the amount of gap that I saw, and by the way, in order to see this gap, you have to take away the capacitor. That's another crazy thing here. When you've got the Windhorst machine operating with its capacitor, essentially every one of the arcs goes directly from one probe to the other probe. But when you remove the capacitor, so that now the magnitude of the discharges, the voltage of the breakdown is the same, but the magnitude of the discharges is orders of magnitude smaller. And the discharges are nowhere near as bright, they're nowhere near as noisy. But now they've got this funny gap phenomenon. And I keep saying that there's a gap around the negative electrode, but no gap at the positive. There's a slim chance I got it backwards. I got to go back and repeat the experiment. And there's a fancy way I can find out which one is positive. Have I told you, John, how I find out which one is positive and which one is negative? I've got two techniques, and I'm not using a voltmeter, believe it or not. I blew out my voltmeter when I first tried to do that. When I'm running my Windhorst machine, and depending on which day of the week, he can decide to start up with the right-hand probe positive or the right-hand probe negative. And I have to find out which one's positive or negative. Have I told you how I do that, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW?
Oh, no. Walk me through that.
There's two techniques. Number one, I can force the right-hand probe to be positive by turning on my 31-inch television set, and I know that the plate of the forward glass on this cathode ray tube of the television set is positively charged. And I bring my Windhorst over to my television set, and I allow the right-hand probe to touch the glass of the cathode ray tube of the television set while it's operating. Now when I turn the handle, every time the right-hand side will be positive, so I can force it to be positive. But if I didn't do that, I just started up, and I now want to know which one is positive and which one is negative. I can find out real fast by the way I aim the probes at each other. There's a round bulb at the end of each one of these probes, and there's a long rod holding that bulb. If the right-hand side is positive, and if I tilt the right-hand probe so that it aims itself into the middle of the shaft of the left-hand probe, then I get a very nice zap, zap, zap discharge. And if the right-hand side is positive and the left-hand side is negative, and I reverse the procedure, I take the left-hand probe and I aim it toward the middle of the rod of the right-hand probe, I get no zapping at all. I just get a sizzling sound. When the E field is large near the negative probe, the electrons are so portable, they start leaving immediately, and you get a whole bunch of corona discharge and a whole bunch of sizzling. When you reverse it, when the positive probe is the one that's aimed toward the shaft of the negative, and therefore there's a very strong local E-field bunch of circles around that right-hand probe, and that's and the electrons are not there. Those are the non-electrons, if you know what I mean. They're not very portable, the nucleuses of the atoms. Because they're so...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Because they're so non-portable, no corona discharge occurs until you finally get a breakdown. Then you get a beautiful zap. So without even using a voltmeter, that's polarity sensitive, either by the television set or by that testing technique, and you read enough of the websites about Wim Hof machines, you eventually find out about this favorite technique of the way you position the probes to get the most beautiful display. I wonder if you've ever heard about this one, John. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Oh, no, Dick, I haven't, but I understand how that works, and that is a great discovery. That is very interesting. Okay. But I was curious to see if rotating it in the Earth magnetic field would make any difference, because that may have been a tip or a clue. But I don't know if the Thompson vessel was done that way.
Yeah, what I've discovered by use of a Wim Hof machine and a Van de Graaff generator is that when you're doing high voltage experiments, I get a lot more pleasure out of using DC voltage than AC voltage. I will admit it's nice and easy to make a very high voltage AC with a Tesla coil. But because the high voltage discharge from a Tesla coil is always an AC voltage, you're getting a certain number of half-cycle positive discharges, a certain number of half-cycle negative charges, these polarity-sensitive effects become mishmashed and you don't see them.
If you charge that a drive that with the square poles that has the positive offset, there's no negative effect to you.
Okay. A Wim Hof machine is the one with these two records rotating opposite directions from each other. Two records that are... You've got two plastic sheets of material, round sheets of material, that are very close to each other. One's rotating clockwise, one's rotating counterclockwise. There's a bunch of metal strips on those plastic sheets and a bunch of contacting devices that are adding and subtracting charge from those metal chips strips as they rotate. That machine, with its capacitor charging, its Leyden jars, has enough trouble slowly generating a nice high 100 kilovolt DC voltage. I don't know of any good way that I could superimpose a square wave of 100 kilovolts on top of that DC voltage of 100 kilovolts. It would be interesting. But in other words, what you're saying is that if I've now got a rectified high voltage, if there's some way I could rectify the voltage out of a Tesla coil, if I could rectify the voltage out of a Tesla coil, and in theory, you and I can buy rectifying diodes that are good to 100 kilovolts. They're a little bit expensive, but in theory, we could do that. But now there's another problem. And that is, the Tesla coil has a primary coil at the bottom that you excite and a zillion turns of a secondary coil, and you get the maximum voltage out of the Tesla coil when the two of them are resonant. It's a resonance phenomena that builds up a great big voltage on the secondary coil. And now if I start rectifying that AC voltage of resonance, and I've now made a cyclic loading only on the positive half cycle and not on the negative half cycle, would I still have resonance? Would I still get the same amount of performance? I think it's possible to retune it, but I think a lot of retuning would be required in order to still get a high voltage into those rectifiers. But that's another great experiment to be done.
Be better off building a Van de Graaff generator.
Okay, maybe what I should do is add a Tesla coil to the output of a Van de Graaff generator, or add a Tesla coil to the output of a Wim Hof machine. Combine the two. Maybe now we're talking. Now that's a way that we can get our cake and eat it too, so to speak. What do you think, John?
Yeah, I'd like to picture the Van de Graaff generator, the Windhurst machine, discharging into the primary coil of that Tesla coil. That would be a show and a half.
Not really. When you're really using a high